United States foreign policy, the question of imperialism. Much of the world today believes that the United States is the leading imperialist nation. We, for the most part, dismiss this charge as mere communist rhetoric. We notice the frequency with which they insert that word imperialist as an adjective in sentences, along with words like revisionist, left-wing, deviationist, adventurist, and all this other rhetoric, and we don't pay too much attention. But we ought to note the fact that we are no longer being called the world's leading imperialist country exclusively behind the Iron Curtain and the Bamboo Curtain. This charge is increasingly being leveled at us from the countries of Africa and Latin America. And even in the United States, there is a mounting conviction among many people that the United States is indeed guilty of something called imperialism. Probably that belief is, at the present time, pretty much centered in young people, black people, and other undesirable elements. Now, the people who use the term generally, not always of course, but generally know what they mean by it, and so they don't bother defining it. On the other hand, we are so convinced that it's just rhetoric that we don't ask for a definition. If somebody calls me a sniveling gutter snipe, I don't say, "Would you please define your term?" I say something intelligent like, "You are too." What do they mean by imperialist? They mean something very specific. The original architects of that term, there are actually quite a few people, but the three men whom I would single out as having been most influential in coining the meaning of imperialism are John Hobson, who was a sort of maverick English economist who wrote his most influential books in the first decade of this century, and an Austrian Marxist. Hobson was not a Marxist, by the way. An Austrian Marxist named Rudolf Hilferding, who also wrote around 1910, and then most especially Lenin, who borrowed heavily from Hilferding and also other people, but probably Lenin, well, I think certainly Lenin is the man who has been most responsible for defining the term Leninism and making it popular among people. Now, what is imperialism? Imperialism is capitalism in its most developed form. Now, I'm not going to mention all of the many aspects of the most developed form of capitalism because I want to focus on foreign policy. According to the argument, when a capitalist country becomes mature, and hence becomes imperialist, it runs into several problems. Now, for quite a while now, I'm simply going to be giving the line. I'm not going to keep saying this is what they say. I'm not going to indicate whether I agree or disagree. I'm trying to summarize the argument. Under capitalism, income is distributed in such a way as to make mass consumption impossible. Such a heavy percentage of the income goes to such a small percentage of the people that the output of the highly productive capitalist economy is continually in danger of going begging for want of a market. There are plenty of people who would like to have more things, but capitalism doesn't give them enough income to purchase it. So capitalism is always running out of consumers. Then there's a related problem. Where does that income go if it doesn't go to the masses of the people? Well, it goes to the capitalists, of course, and they aren't able to consume all of it, so what they do is they plow it back. They reinvest it, and this has the effect of making the whole capitalist system even more productive. Output increases even more. Meanwhile, of course, the people are unable to consume everything that's being produced. And as a result, capitalism is continually in danger of foundering for want of markets. Crises regularly appear. There just isn't enough demand. Goods pile up in warehouses, and there's no one to sell them. To buy them. A crisis sets in, capitalism has depression. Of course, when the capitalists cannot sell their goods, they cannot get a profit. And so with regular shortages of markets, insufficient demand, the capitalists experience declining profit rates. Well, this makes them very unhappy. But what they begin to do is they cast covetous eyes around throughout the rest of the world. They look beyond their borders, and they see millions, billions of people outside of their borders to whom they could perhaps sell some of these surplus goods which are going begging. And they enlist the state to try to extend their economic control throughout the world so as to be able to do, now, three things. First of all, secure markets for their surplus output in the less developed countries of the world. Secondly, they are eager to secure safe and profitable investment opportunities. You see, at home, they have used up the best investment opportunities, and now they're looking around for places to invest their accumulated surplus, places that will pay the same high returns that they got used to in the earlier days of capitalism. And the third thing that they want to do is they want to use the power of their state to guarantee a reliable flow of raw materials from the less developed countries of the world, because the highly developed capitalist economies are very prodigal in their use of raw materials, and they want to guarantee reliable and cheap sources of these raw materials. So the task of the state in the 19th century, for all the capitalist countries, became to secure for domestic producers safe, reliable markets in Asia, Africa, Latin America, to guarantee the safety of the investments of the Western European and American capitalists, and to make sure that the natives didn't get restless and cut off the reliable flow of raw materials. Until World War II, this resulted in something called overt colonialism. Europe carved up Africa. Well, we're all familiar with the story of the sun never set on the British Empire, and the sun never set on the Portuguese Empire and everything else. Everybody, all these countries were out getting their empire. Some of them were more crude in doing it. The United States was always very skillful about it. We dressed it up with fancier rhetoric. The countries of Europe would simply sit down at the table and divide up Africa. But the United States, we would always send missionaries in first and bring enlightenment to the heathen and establish a friendly protectorate. But the whole thing resulted in the establishment of colonies. And the countries of the capitalist countries competed against one another to acquire colonies because their domestic economies were dependent upon these colonies. Well, the trouble is the world is limited in size too. And as all the capitalist countries were out there lusting after colonies, they began to fight with one another. And the result was World War I and then World War II. World Wars I and II are seen by those people who today are using the phrase imperialism as direct results of the struggle of the capitalist countries, the mature capitalist countries, to guarantee for themselves markets, investment opportunities, and reliable flow of raw materials. Well, World War I was bad enough, but World War II was even worse. The thieves fell out so badly among themselves that the victims partially escaped. The great colonial empires broke up. But under the leadership of the United States, after World War II, a more subtle form of imperialism was devised. The United States was able to assume leadership because it was the only one of the leading capitalist countries to emerge from World War II in a relatively stronger position, a much stronger position. The United States secured harmony among all the thieves, among all the capitalist countries, and became the acknowledged leader. We established the Pax Americana. Now, the goals of the whole system did not change, and the consequences remained largely the same, but the methods changed. After World War II, all of these colonial countries, or practically all of them, were allowed to become independent. We no longer sent in our troops, our governor generals, and so on, at least not openly. We made less use of gunboats, and we made more use of bribery. In particular, the upper classes, the large landowners, the few bourgeoisie, the few industrialists, and generally the wealthy classes, in these newly, quote, independent countries, the former colonial countries, were placed under United States protection. The upper classes were given our protection on the condition that these upper classes permit the United States to dominate their economies. And all the tactics that, and here are some of the tactics that we use to
exercise this dominance. Foreign aid. Now, that's very interesting. Usually the people in the United States who opposed foreign aid have been the right-wingers. So that's what we think, anyhow. But they think the foreign aid is just good old kindly Uncle Sam pouring money down the rat hole. But now these people are saying, no, foreign aid was actually a very clever tool by which the United States gave grants and aid and help to a relatively few people in these less developed countries, made them wealthy on the condition that they would permit the United States to exercise domination over their economies. Private investment by capitalist countries, military assistance, military advisors, occasional assistance from the CIA. Guatemala, probably the clearest example, the one that's now admitted. And only in desperate circumstances would the United States indulge in the outright use of naked American force. But through all of these techniques, we have managed to maintain capitalist domination of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Meanwhile, back home, the masses. See, remember, of course, this is a Marxist argument that I'm giving you, essentially. Though Hobson was not a Marxist, Hobson really had few followers. It was the Marxists who developed the imperialist analysis. But according to the Marxists now, the proletariat here in the United States should have been revolting. About the time that our capitalist economy and the Western European capitalist economies became mature, the masses should have been so desperate and the economy should have been in such sorry condition, the wealth should have been so heavily concentrated in the hands of so few, capitalism should have gone through so many crises and so on and so on, that the proletariat would have arisen, overthrown the oppressors, exploited the exploiters, ushered in the socialists. So first of all, of course, the dictatorship of the proletariat. But that obviously hasn't happened. I mean, the dictatorship is and the proletariat is not notably dictating policy in the United States. Well, what's happened is that the capitalists really got smart. They have seduced the masses, the wage earners, the blacks, all the oppressed here at home, into cooperating with them in their policy of worldwide exploitation. And they've done this by two means, principally. The first is, again, outright bribery, a matter of sharing the spoils. The bourgeoisie in the United States got really smart, and they realized that they could not preserve their unjust gains unless they cut the masses of the people in for a share of the boodle. They sort of said, look, fellas, don't revolt against me. Let's you and me exploit them. So that today, the Marxists tend not to regard the working classes in the capitalist countries as potentially revolutionary forces. The class struggle today is not carried on really between classes so much as it is carried on between nations. That we have today bourgeois nations, bourgeois capitalist nations, where the big bourgeoisie, the large corporations, have as I said, bribed the people into supporting their policies, and they are exploiting the rest of the world. And because it pays off very well for the typical American working man, he lives rather well, he acquiesces in all of this and votes Republican. There's a second technique that has been used by the bourgeoisie to keep the masses from revolting against this policy and throwing them out of office, and that is they have created the myth that what the United States is doing in the world is not suppressing revolution and preserving capitalist domination over underdeveloped countries, but it is fighting to preserve and extend freedom and democracy throughout the world. And this myth, which originates in Wall Street, has been bought by the American public, or widely bought. Well, what's the consequence of the whole system? A major consequence of it is that the less developed countries are trapped in poverty. The economic growth that they experience is a very partial and extremely unbalanced kind of economic growth. But that is all that the United States and its allies will allow to occur. We are not interested in the total development of the countries of Latin America, Asia, and Africa. We are interested exclusively in their development along lines which benefit us. Thus, we are extremely interested in developing their raw materials. We want Brazil to produce a lot of coffee because we drink coffee. And of course, we like to see them producing oil and tin and rubber or whatever, I don't know, kinds of raw materials we particularly want today. But we invest capital in these countries primarily in the extractive industries. We encourage the governments, which are really our puppets, to develop their economies so that these economies will provide markets for some of the things that we particularly want to sell, and, as I said, a reliable flow of raw materials. And so in most of these less developed countries, what we have seen since World War II, despite tremendous interest in and enthusiasm for economic development, we have seen a very limited amount of development, and we have seen dual economies arise, so that you will find, for example, in Venezuela, that a very small part of the economy, concentrated along the seacoast, looks modern, Western, industrialized. People make a pretty good income. But the great masses of the people out in the hinterlands are living in abysmal poverty. Imperialist policy has created small enclaves of modern industrialized economies and has left large primitive economies and most of the people continuing in starvation. But since the beneficiaries of this policy are in control, backed by the United States, it is impossible for the masses of the people to affect any change. Thus, revolution is the prerequisite of economic development. Throughout Asia, Africa, and Latin America, revolution is sine qua non. Until there is a revolution which overturns this small group of wealthy people, the former, the national bourgeoisie, as they're sometimes called, the large landowners, the political class, there's a kind of vaguely defined alliance, sometimes called the clerical military bourgeois alliance, landowner alliance. But until this small but very powerful group of people is overturned, wholesale, balanced economic development will not occur, and most of the people of the world will continue to blunder along in misery and abysmal poverty. Well, why don't they have revolutions? Well, the answer, of course, is that the United States stifles all revolutions in the name of anti-communism and freedom and democracy. If the people begin to realize what is happening to them, and they see that all of this marvelous foreign aid and United States investment and all that isn't doing them any good, if they begin to notice that it's all going into the pockets of the same people who used to be exploiting them, and they start talking about revolution, the United States sends in military advisors, the CIA, and of course just direct military assistance to these governments, and enables the governments to put down the revolution. Well, that's it. It's a pretty ghastly story. Is it true? Well, theses as broad as the one I've just tried to describe are extremely difficult to prove. And they are also extremely difficult to refute. I mean, if you take a broad enough interpretation of history, you can always get away with it. Arguments such as this tend to take on the character of an ideology. That is to say, they don't just inform thinking, they stifle thinking. And that's the danger of it. Of course, they also nerve people to action. This argument it has a religious quality for many people. I know personally some young men for whom this argument is a call to action that's reminiscent of the Easter call to action in the early Christian church. I know young men who are willing to lay down their lives because they believe this is true and that the monster, the United States, must be strangled. And they see themselves as in the bowels of the monster, and they are going to strangle it. The tragic young men of the Weatherman movement are all people who believe this, who become almost desperate in their belief that the United States is inflicting untold misery upon billions of people for the sake of its own selfish and short-sighted interests. And they are willing to sacrifice their lives to destroy the imperialist system. But though it is, as I say, I think impossible right now to either prove or refute this argument, I think we can attempt to assess it. And there are some things that I would like to now suggest. And then, having suggested them, I'll throw the thing open for your suggestions, refutations, comments. I was hoping that Herb, I don't know, I'll see when I'm finished whether Herb is going to be willing to say a few words in rejoinder. Herb Loddick, sitting back there, tends to... May I quote your remark? He says he'd like me to be in charge of U.S. Can I... U.S. domestic policy and Russian foreign policy. he's not a man of few words, so he'd be a good one to say something to receive. Well, anyway, we'll see. It seems to me in the first place that the declining markets argument and the declining rate of profit argument, which is a part, one of the, these are two of the three cornerstones of the imperialist thesis, are extremely weak. The under-consumptionist thesis has never been rigorously or consistently argued. I don't want to get into technical economics here, but let me just pose one question. If it's true that capitalism has always kept the masses so poor that they couldn't buy the products of the capitalist system, so that goods piled up and eventually there was a crisis due to insufficient demand, how did the capitalist countries ever get out of those crises? You know, did they all of a sudden say, okay, masses, we'll give you a little income for a while so that you can buy these goodies and we can recover? This has always been the weak side of the under-consumptionist case. There are all sorts of reasons, statistical and logical, why economists have, as they have, tended to look very suspiciously upon the under-consumptionist argument. The argument, in other words, that because capitalism doesn't put enough income in the hands of the masses, finds itself unable to sell all of the things that it produces. But even if the argument had been valid at one time, we have learned, it seems to me, and it seems to most Western economists, we have learned since the 1930s how to handle problems that arise from insufficient total demand. This is what the Keynesian revolution is all about. And though the Keynesian revolution has been a considerable reaction against it, today 98% of Western economists believe that capitalism can get along quite nicely without any serious depressions. We'll have ups and downs, but no serious real crises that are likely to provoke a revolution. And we know how to prevent this sort of thing. As a matter of fact, through government use of fiscal and monetary policy or the manipulation of total demand, it should be possible for a capitalist country to live in complete isolation without really experiencing any crises due to shortages of markets or crises due to falling investment opportunity, falling profit rates and declining investment opportunities. But the third pillar in the argument strikes me as much more cogent. The argument that the United States, let me just focus on the United States as the leading imperialist country, is extremely worried about the sources of its raw materials. It seems to me that concern for raw materials, for reliable access to raw materials, is one of the impetuses of our foreign policy. I am judging by the statements that we make. We consume huge quantities of raw materials, some of them very rare, but very quite vital, and available only from countries of Africa, Latin America. And we do worry about our continued access to these raw materials. Very often when you hear the domino theory expressed, you'll say, well, if this country goes, then that one will go, and if that one goes, this one is likely to go, and then look how many will be cut off from vital raw materials. Well, if we talk this way, I suspect this concern is influencing our policy. But I would suggest that there is a pillar upon which the imperialist argument can be built that the Marxists have neglected. They have suggested, you recall I said, that we talk about the necessity of defending freedom and democracy as a kind of a cloak for this whole thing. I wonder if the cloak has not become an independent impetus to policy. Let me put it this way, that we have so thoroughly believed our own rhetoric, which was designed merely to dress up a policy intended to accomplish something else, that our rationale has become a reason. I don't know, as you listen to a lot of Americans talking about, say, American involvement in Vietnam, I get the feeling, at least, that if the big corporations and the big capitalists who are supposed to have invented this argument were to say tomorrow, oh, baloney, we aren't fighting for freedom and democracy at all, the proletariat would arise and say, you're crazy, we sure are fighting for freedom and democracy. I suspect that the concern to extend the American version of freedom and democracy throughout the world is more deeply and sincerely held among the working classes than it is among the people who are supposed to be the primary beneficiaries of the imperialist policy. And, that really bothers me. The trouble is, we are talking and acting very much today, and now I'm certainly getting into matters that are highly debatable, but the United States is talking and acting as if we really could and should bring freedom and democracy to the whole world, which strikes me as arrogant, dangerous, and impossible. Arrogant because I don't think a lot of people care particularly for Jeffersonian freedom and democracy. Dangerous because it involves us in all kinds of things that could flare up and have flared up into something bigger and something that we may not be capable of handling. And finally, impossible. No nation, no concert of nations today has the power to impose its way of life throughout the world. And the attempt to do so can result in national suicide. But there's something else that's now related to this. We seem to have subscribed wholeheartedly to what I would call the monolithic communism thesis. The thesis that every time a country goes socialist, it automatically becomes a staunch ally of all of the other socialist countries, and though they may temporarily fall out among themselves, basically they are engaged in a monolithic conspiracy to terminate our way of life, to destroy the United States and our economic system and our freedom and our democracy. So that it is essential for us to intervene against socialist revolutionaries simply in self-defense. In other words, the world is dividing up. There's the socialists who are out to destroy us, there are the capitalists who are out to keep them from doing it, and then there are all the non-aligned in-between countries, and both sides are singing them a siren song. Now it is essential that we keep our enemies from becoming stronger. And the way to keep our enemies from becoming stronger is to prevent socialist revolutions anywhere where they're likely to occur. I think that in subscribing to the monolithic communism thesis, we have given insufficient attention to two other things. One is just the limits of our power. Now, even if it were demonstrably in our interest to prevent a socialist revolution anywhere in the world, that gets to be rather hard to do. Gets very costly. But I think there's something else that we've neglected, which I call the indigestion thesis. I am not at all sure, I'll put it more strongly, I am quite certain that countries which join the Soviet or Chinese bloc become in a short number of years, very few years, bigger problems than assets. I think we've seen this happen now in Eastern Europe. Certainly, the countries of Eastern Europe have not become Jeffersonian, democratic, capitalist countries, but they certainly have been a pain in the neck to Russia. There is, on the perimeter of China, a good deal of extremely deep anti-Chinese feeling, just as there is in Mexico a good deal of anti-gringo feeling. The people of Vietnam are not terribly eager to have their country controlled by the Chinese, just as the people of Eastern Europe aren't terribly eager to have their countries controlled by the Russians. Now sure, these countries will take aid from the Russians and allow socialists and communists, perhaps, to operate rather freely within their borders. But aren't they doing it? Now, they may get outfoxed. I'm not saying they're going to outfox the Russians. But it's a sensible thing to do. If you can play off the Russians and the Americans against one another and thereby get some things that you want, why not do it? And, of course, if you can say, we're socialist, and thereby get huge amounts of Russian aid, why not say it? It seemed to me that after Castro was determined to turn Cuba socialist. But after the United States responded by saying, a pox upon you and all your works, it seemed to me that Castro had no choice but to come out and say, we are Marxist-Leninist! And then that's how the Russians send them goodies. But I note the fact that Cuba is a substantial drain upon the Russian economy. And I suspect that late at night, the leaders in the Kremlin wish that the United States would take Cuba over. Well, let me wind up. I'll ask three questions, and I'll answer them plonkingly, and then I'll ask you, Herb, if you'll say something. Is the United States throttling socialist revolutions throughout the world? Without any doubt. It certainly is. It isn't denied. Is it in the interest of those countries that we prevent socialist revolutions? I don't know. I do think it is not ours to say. I really don't know. I do believe, I get with increasing firmness, that the plight of these countries is desperate, and that a social revolution is required in many of these countries before broad-scale economic development can occur. Does that mean a socialist revolution? Well, there don't seem to be any other revolutionaries around. So if you believe that the kind of wholesale shakeup of the social, economic, political system is essential to clear out the barnacles and the crud, and you need revolutionaries to have a revolution. And the only revolutionaries around in any numbers in Latin America are Marxists. Now, will these people eventually make these countries better off? I don't know. I operate with thesis of the long-term tendency for socialism to turn into capitalism. Maybe what they need is, see, Marx argued that every country should be capitalist at first, and then when it gets wealthy, when it solves its basic problems, then it will turn socialist. I suspect maybe today, in the undeveloped countries, what is necessary is they first become socialist, and then when they develop, then they can turn capitalist. But that's bad talk to my leftist friends. The last question I would ask, I asked, is the United States throttling socialist revolutions? I think it is, without doubt. Is it in the interest of those countries? I don't know. Is it in our interest? That's a very important question. Is it in our interest to throttle socialist revolutions in these countries? And I think it is not. I think we have very little to gain by doing so, and a good deal to lose by attempting to do so. And what I'm calling for then, what I'm suggesting, is a kind of new isolationism. That's a bad word, but I deeply believe that the United States is going to have to learn to operate with restraint in the rest of the world, that we are going to have to learn how to run our economy and our foreign policy with minimum impact upon other countries of the world. Because we cannot deny our power. A powerful nation is going to be a powerful nation whether it wants to be or not. But I think that we have exercised far too little restraint, and we have operated with far too much of a messiah complex. Herb, can I?
Well, I have the question first. What is the alternative then if these other countries don't have democracy? Socialism, or what would be an alternative for other countries? smaller one, say in Africa.
Would you be willing to hold that question? Now let's turn that question over. I'd like Herb to say something in a sort of systematic way, because he disagrees, I think, some crucial points. Okay? Thank you.
Sure, we know that it takes a whole course, really, to get these things across, but I think people should be doing independent study on it. It's too important to be resolved in a few minutes. One thing is the definition of socialism and capitalism. I question whether, we don't have any pure socialist nations. We don't have any pure capitalist nations. What we really have are mixed economies with varying degrees of mixture. And we have ideologies that go with them. It's not the form of the economics of the Soviet Union or of Yugoslavia and so on that bother me so much as the ideology or the almost religious belief that tends to go with them. If you say there are no other revolutionists around, but there are many opinions about that, I believe for one that there would be revolutions without communist revolutionists, without a group that does have a world ideology and speak constantly in such terms. Revolutions would occur, and if they did produce a socialist type of economy, I wouldn't be afraid of that, because right in America we've seen that when you get communistic type economies in the controlled religious groups, for example, they tend to become very wealthy and then to break up. This very often happens. And I think the same thing would happen with most communist nations if they were not controlled by what Jill has called the construction of a new class, an artificial class. Now, Sakharov also seems to feel that way, and I think he ought to be read as a leading communist who I believe is sincerely a man of peace, who might like to see the world communist, or he might not. You can't be absolutely certain by reading his book. But I would suggest that people ought to be willing to spend a dollar and a half to get a book by what many regard as the top nuclear physicist in the Soviet Union, a book called Progress, Coexistence, and Intellectual Freedom, a Times book, that's the same company that now publishes the New York Times, for a dollar and a half. Now, if you can't get it at your bookstore, of course you can always get it at the bookstore of Golden Valley Blues. But they did order 12 more copies here. The first 12 went in about 4 days, I believe. It isn't a question of either or. For in our own nation, I would like to see us nationalize things if we think it pays to. Denationalize when we find it doesn't, or if we find it doesn't. And not be stuck with the idea that if something looks socialist, we must flee from it like the plague. I don't think we should go by these terms. We should simply be asking ourselves what's going to work best at the present time and in view of the problems that we're facing. As far as a monolithic communist thesis is concerned, a pure monolithism is impossible. We see Yugoslavia starting to break away and so on. But we also see Czechoslovakia invaded suddenly by five nations on the same day in the same hour, and this means that there is a very coercive force here and a conspiracy among some nations to keep another nation within this order. We also know on the basis of psychological experiments that if you bombard a people with only one point of view, you almost always win them over. Now that doesn't mean the top brass. This was brought out in 1984 by Orwell too, that the top brass has doubts. And therefore the propaganda ought to be aimed at the top men, because it's hard to get at the lower ones unless we develop new techniques. But to create some sense of self-questioning here, on both sides is what's healthy. But we find this rather difficult to do. With Apprentice Bromatka sincerely believed that he could work in Hungary and from there in other communist countries to produce an attitude that would be favorable to a Christian type of communism. But he was among one of the many that protested against the invasion of Czechoslovakia. He was immediately removed, according to the RCDA. He was of the religious communist army area, published by National Council of Churches. He was removed from all of his offices without a trial. That is not a trial to which he was allowed to speak. He was tried, but he himself complained, I was not allowed to be present at my trial. I was removed from all offices, and as you know, he died just a very short time after that. I suspect that what he died from was the realization that his high expectancies had been crushed, that he could not achieve what he hoped to achieve by his methods, that the other side had not mellowed as he expected. Now, I know Gillis says they will mellow, and I respect Gillis. I have great respect for him. I hope he also isn't over-optimistic here. In other words, I don't have a 100% view yet, but I think we need to be very cautious and to play this like you would play a game of chess. That is, there are times when we ought to be helping a communist nation, and there are times when we shouldn't be. But we should be doing it always with the viewpoint of trying to create within them a healthy and reasonable self-doubt such as we have within our own nation already. This is the problem as I see it.
Okay. No.
Richard, you're up.
I asked my question.
Yeah, would you ask it again?
Oh. I was just wondering what the alternative was between the democracy and for these underprivileged, if you want to call them that, or new emerging nations, over against democracy, which you mentioned would perhaps not be the answer. What would be then for their government? What type of government?
I've got a question when she brings up that question. Is democracy equivalent to capitalism?
Yeah. You're not suggesting democracy is equivalent.
Well, you mentioned Jeffersonian democracy.
Yeah. Well, we don't. Well, I talked about Jeffersonian democracy because we tend not to say that we're fighting to preserve capitalism, but that we're fighting to preserve freedom and democracy in these countries.
Yeah, not capitalism.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I don't think there's no logical reason why capitalism or why socialism and freedom and democracy as we know it are inconsistent, and I don't know if I even have to get into the question of whether they are historically inconsistent, but the Marxists insist that the first stage after the revolution is a dictatorship, a dictatorship of the proletariat, in which of course the party speaks as the voice of the proletariat. So I don't think it's unfair in mere capitalist rhetoric to say that the socialists are trying to create a dictatorship. They are, but they call it a dictatorship in the interest of the great masses of the people. Now, does this disturb us? I don't know, am I getting at your question? No, let me keep on. If I'm not, then cut me off. Does this disturb us? I don't know. I think it disturbs a lot of people. I think we would like to believe, because I believe Americans are really basically full of goodwill, we would like to believe that it's possible for every country in the world to develop economically and become tolerably well off, to have enough food, enough clothing, and decent shelter, and so on, without suppressing basic freedoms, without destroying at least the semblance of democracy. Maybe it is impossible. Maybe it is. Democracy doesn't work too well in a country where large numbers of people are illiterate, where people do not have not been reared accepting certain traditions such as the idea of a loyal opposition,
where people have not been taught to believe that in the clash of political opinions there is health, vigor. I regard United States democracy, and I think we still have it, and our freedom, as a very precious heritage which we fortunately received from the British. I've been impressed in looking around the world at what a fragile plant democracy really is. You know, democracy hasn't worked terribly well. I think it's worked well in England, in the United States. It's worked well in countries which derive their political traditions from England. It's worked well in a few very small countries, you know, like the Scandinavian countries and Switzerland. But where else has it worked? France, chronic problems with it. After the French Revolution, there was a succession of, you know, restorations. The French live very uneasily with democracy. And they're probably the next best example. Germany? Sorry, Herb. Germany doesn't seem to have any really strong passion for democracy. Maybe we've oversold the problem. No, I don't want to say we've oversold, because I like democracy. But maybe we have kidded ourselves into supposing that democracy is really attainable for most people. Quite possibly it isn't. After all, democracy isn't the only form of government that is for the people. There have been benevolent despots. I don't want one. I don't like them. But if the alternative to a benevolent despot is, the alternatives are chaos or tyranny, I guess I'd prefer a benevolent despot. And it's quite possible that these are the only alternatives facing many of these countries at this moment in history. Either chaos or a tyranny of a small oligarchy. Does that? Yeah, I don't know who is willing.
Okay. Yes. Herb raises a rather interesting point when he points out that there is no pure system, at least when you contrast capitalism with communism. Would you both then agree that if we look at not the idea of democracy, I personally believe that democracy is still a figment of our imagination and hasn't really happened anywhere in the world to this point. America may be the one place that there is some possibility of its working. But the idea of mixed economy or mixed ideology intrigues me, because that sort of comes right out of our community, where we say, and we say unequivocally, that America is a country with mixed ideology and mixed economy, i.e. socialism for the up people, the rich, and capitalism for the poor.
What's the question? Well, what do I think of that?
Yeah, whether or not you agree then that we've got a mixed economy and mixed ideology going for us here.
Well, on
well, you see, there's this little book called Who Rules America. Are you familiar with it?
Who wrote it?
Well, it's written by...
Denhoff.
Teaches down at Santa Cruz now, at the University of California. And he chases rather logically the control of this country back to a rather well-fashioned, well-formed, almost impenetrable socialistic group who meet periodically behind magnolia blossoms and high fences. And so far he's only been able to name one, and he might as well be named in his group. His name is Strom Thurmond, who saddled Nixon with Agnew and who saddled some other people with some other people, and has some rather interesting connections with the World Bank. You see, more than interesting connections, he has some control with it. Now this is coming out in Dimhoff's latest little thing, which is the extension of the book Who Rules America. He buys then the principle of mixed ideology and mixed economy, always dictated by the trickery which the up people are able to use. They maintain their system, which is safe for them, almost purely socialistic, and they impose another system on the down people and the up-down people, which is almost purely capitalistic.
Yeah, well, in order to deal with that, we're going to have to define terms. I do not know how to define socialism, simply because there is no definition of socialism no single definition of socialism that would be accepted by every major group calling itself socialist. That's a problem. You know, I mean, you can say state ownership of the means of production. What do you do with the anarchist socialists? They don't believe in the state. Most of us think of socialism as essentially nationalization and state ownership. And there is no doubt that that's what Marx had in mind. Marx didn't talk much about the future socialist and much less about the future communist society. You know, after socialism eventually comes communism, because he figured when the time came, history would provide the solutions. But where he does talk about it, he leaves no doubt that what he thought, for him, capitalism was anarchy. Socialism was state ownership of the means of production, so that they are used, operated in the interests of all the people. Well, if that's what we mean by socialism, state ownership of the means of production, and you can quarrel about how many of all the means of production are just the leading industries, I don't think the United States is socialist. If you use something like Servan Schreiber's definition of socialism...
Let's take that one.
Servan Schreiber's?
Yes.
Yeah. A highly developed welfare state, where everybody's taken care of. Well, and almost by definition, we have socialism for the rich. Because, I guess, by definition, the rich are well taken care of. They're rich.
The government works to take care of them, too.
Well, now, wait a minute. But if you insert that, is the government operating to take care of the rich? Then I would say yes, but in a subtle way. The government is operating to take care of the rich by protecting all sorts of little vested interests, frequently in the name of capitalism.
Farm subsidies,
protection to labor unions, craft unions in particular, which keep out the blacks and the really poor people, redistribute income from the poor to the rich,
oil depletion allowances,
almost all forms of licensing.
Big tax write-off.
Yeah. But I would focus more on the kinds of, the ways in which the government prevents competition. The government is continually, and not just the federal government, state and local governments are notorious for this. They're continually intervening to stifle competition in the interests of those people who are already in the industry. And this does have the effect of preserving, to some extent, the profits, but I think to a larger extent, the quiet life of the people who are in the industry. You know, every time you get an industry going, they say, gee, we got to get together and form a little association to look after our interests. The next thing you know, they're screaming about all of the abuses in this industry, which require government intervention. And a lot of people think that the meatpacking industry came under regulation because there was a vast popular outcry about all this tainted meat. And the truth is, if you look at the historical record, it's very clear that for a couple of decades before the government finally stepped in and regulated slaughtering, the big meatpackers were screaming for it. They were demanding it, because they knew that the little meat packers wouldn't be able to pay the associated expenses, because they were going to have to pay for those government inspectors. And they believed that this would eliminate most of the small meat slaughterers from the business and protect the profits of the few large ones. Now, this has happened over and over again. Our government is deeply involved in subsidizing General Motors, United States Steel, American Telephone and Telegraph, all of the oil companies, and on down the list.
One more final point, then I'm finished. From my rather naive layman's posture, I see us being plagued by a plethora of conglomerates. When you start talking about... that's not a group of flying insects, by the way. It's totally consistent with the question I've raised. And I think that we might do well at this point to work with a rather unacceptable definition of what socialism is for our own purposes here, Paul, as opposed to drawing down the curtain between the two prevailing opinions. For my benefit, and then we can maybe move on to the others.
Well, but if our interest is, as it is tonight, and because I said it is, you asked for a policy, I'm not sure how far we're going to get by. Where are we going to get anywhere by following this?
Well, you wanted to say something.
I didn't know how much you were thinking, but...
You want to put your question in the ice box? Or?
Yeah, let's wait.
All right, it's in the ice box.
Yes, sir. Well, I guess I have two points to make. One, in listening to all this discussion, I guess we're all aware that there's trouble with definitions. We're talking about two or three things at the same time here. An economic system, which is a capitalist versus socialist, a social action type of effort, and a political system. And these get intermixed because we don't have any purity. And it's true we can have one without the other. So I think in trying to discuss this tonight, we're essentially trying to talk about economics, I guess. And these things don't necessarily separate out. There are other factors that come in and complicate the thing, such as the rate of population growth, which is a horrendous thing. And it's disturbing, I think, all Marxist theories or any other theories. And so it makes it very difficult to understand. Second point I want to make was, I don't know how many, recently in Newsweek, there was a sort of a capsule summary by six historians, American historians, saying what's wrong with this country, going for the dogs, and why. One of them was Staunton Lynn, who you may recognize as somewhat of a leftist type of a theorist in the field of economy and others. Anyway, he was going back to the Depression. He was saying that Roosevelt didn't cure the Depression. He put the economy back on its former state of misery, where there was a large number of people in the same level of poverty as before by 1939, and that it wasn't cured. It was only the World War II that cured the Depression. And ever since World War II, this country has had almost a foreign policy and an internal domestic policy, which has said that we must have massive government subsidies or orders to defense industries, NASA, large things, and you must therefore, to justify all this, get involved in foreign intrigues and adventures. And so he's saying that we must someday come to a more socialist system in this country if we are to survive. We can't continue this thing. And of course, he's also pointing out there's a great deal of hypocrisy when we're talking about a capitalist system. You take in our own state of here in Washington, look at the big defense orders that go to Boeing, for instance. The worker who works for Boeing, is he a socialist worker? He almost is, because the dollars in his pocket are only one step removed from the federal treasury. And we have countless things like this. Everywhere we turn, perhaps 6 out of 10 of us are getting our income in some form from government taxes. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to show Lynn's thoughts in here, because it seems to bear on his maybe a distorted view, but this is what one man is saying when looking at our whole mess that we've got in our American republic today.
Let me make two comments on that. I think that argument needs to be separated out into the two strands. There's the argument that some industries, the aircraft industry is the best example, are so heavily dependent on government spending, which will not occur unless we are engaging in military adventures overseas, and that these industries are so large that there is a substantial war lobby arising out of these industries. I would just find it almost impossible to say that's untrue. Just knowing human nature,
it seems to me that you do get, even with the best subjective intentions in the world, a kind of a... Well, let me put it this way. If you're working in a factory that's producing fighter airplanes, you are, other things equal, more likely to be a hawk than if you're working in a factory producing sewing needles. I'll just make that modest statement and let it go. And of course, if you're interested, then lobbies appear and so on. And you know, Eisenhower's warning against the military-industrial complex was, I think, his greatest contribution to the United States, the greatest contribution of his presidency. But there's another argument, the argument that the whole economy avoids depression only through massive government military expenditures. Now, it's true, no doubt about it. Conservatives and radicals all agree that the Great Depression of the 1930s was ended by World War II. But what we learned from World War II was that a sufficiently massive infusion of government spending could end any depression. And people said, well, gee, why, well, it's not necessary to go fight a war to do that. Why not spend it on things like housing for the poor and roads and schools and post offices and other good things, Well, the answer comes back, practically speaking, politically, given the political realities of the country, we can't do that. Because the American people will tolerate, say, $40 billion a year for airplanes and tanks and missiles, but they won't tolerate $40 billion a year just given over to the poor. They won't tolerate $10 billion in the form of income supplements to poor people. That's just, for some reason, heretical, So the only alternative we have, is to put it into the war machine. But the trouble with that is, I agree. It seems to me the American people are much more willing to accept the high level of federal spending if that's going. When people complain about the big federal budget, they're almost always complaining about all that welfare spending. And when you say, well, take a look at the federal budget and notice if we cut out all the welfare, we really wouldn't be reducing federal spending by a whole lot. If you really are serious about cutting out all this federal government spending, you better look at the military budget. Those people just aren't interested in looking at the military budget. But what bothers me about the argument is that I fail to see the mechanism by which, if this were true, if it were true that the American economy could be kept prosperous, kept out of a depression, only by a high level of government expenditures, I fail to see the mechanism by which this insight is being made effective. I do not buy most conspiratorial interpretations of anything. And I don't find today many people except radical historians, radical critics, who are arguing this thesis very intelligently. The people who guide our corporations, most of our working people and the great middle class, I think do not believe that we need a war to maintain prosperity. I may be wrong, where do I get my information from? I'm just talking to people. It's highly subjective and impressionistic. But I don't believe that most Americans believe this. I don't believe that the leaders of the people who guide the destinies of the big corporations believe this. And I'm quite certain that the overwhelming majority of American economists do not believe this. And that the people who are giving economic advice to the president and are controlling the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, they do not believe this. So the president believes it. Oh, you always believe the worst of the president. But consequently, I reject the thesis. I don't think that the United States is engaging in military adventures overseas and keeping the anti-communist pot boiling in order to keep us out of a depression. Now notice, that's not the same thing as saying if it all stopped, we would go into a depression. I don't believe that if it all stopped, we would have to go into a depression. I think we would only go into a depression, if we declared peace tomorrow and cut out all of this military spending, there would be some enormous dislocations.
but through the use of fiscal and monetary techniques, which I think we know how to use, we could prevent a depression. We might be so stupid as not to use them. But I may be wrong about that. It really hasn't been tested. The argument that was advanced in the 1930s that the American economy had become so prosperous, our income levels were so high, that saving was so great, and investment opportunities had so dried up, that investment in turn was so low, that we would have a chronic tendency toward depression. This so-called stagnation thesis has never been refuted empirically, you know, because we've really not had any period of time greater than 3 years in which the government was not engaging in massive military expenditures. That in that three-year period was the period when all of this pent-up demand that had been accumulated during World War II was flooding into the market and preventing a depression. I mean, although a lot of people during World War II were predicting a depression right after the war, they were really being rather silly. Because, you know, consumers had huge bank accounts and they'd run out of everything. The refrigerator, the washing machine, the automobile, they all needed replacing. And what we had right after World War II was not a depression, but a terrific inflation. That's a long answer to your question. But
I've got a question. Mm-hmm. This really reflects back to the definition that we were talking about. Is the question we're trying to think about tonight to what extent we should interfere in other countries' economies?
Yeah, that's one of the questions I want us to think about. Yeah.
In connection with that, if we make our own definitions and work with that, it still gives us some kind of a rational basis as to whether we should interfere or not, and if we should or shouldn't, how much, or even if the definitions don't agree with other people's definitions.
Well, what do you say? Should we interfere?
Well, Colonel Sanders is going to start talking Japanese in a couple of weeks.
So Colonel Sanders is going to start talking Japanese in a couple of weeks.
Paul, I missed part of the dialogue here, and so at the risk of asking a question the second time somebody else may have asked, just for my sake in this, the United States, it seems to me now, in many countries where we have, in a sense, gone and occupied a country, is it not true that financially, this particular country, particular instance, Japan, West Germany, and some of these other countries that we have occupied, really coming to a utopia in a sense, financially, following our domination, shall we say?
We occupied Germany and West Germany and Japan, and they have been the great economic success stories of the post-World War II era. Japan is a fantastic success story, an incredible rate of economic growth that's never been realized in history during the 1960s. Was it due to our occupation? Well, was it due to our imposition of capitalism and democracy? Will says no. I say I don't know.
Japan had such a booming economy before World
Good
War
Lord,
II.
Yes, man.
I mean, it had the fastest growing economy before World
sure.
War II. They came from 1900 until the time they started to engage in war. They had almost a complete industrial revolution. So it was not a quick start at industrialization or anything like that. It was a continuation of what they had before.
No, same thing for West Germany, of course.
Yeah.
But then
so,
how has the United States intervention in these countries, and this goes back to what you had originally stated, that the thesis as our domination has eventually exploited countries, how has the United States then exploited these countries?
Well, I wasn't suggesting that the United States had exploited Japan and West Germany.
No, I know you weren't, but you were explaining Marxism.
Well, they aren't suggesting this either. They aren't that the West Germany and Japan are U.S. allies in this whole thing. They are co-conspirators in the whole imperialist operation.
Yeah, I see what.
And of course, the essential thing is,
in these countries, as Jerry pointed out, Japan and, of course, West Germany, had already developed before World War II. They had the social, political, economic infrastructure that is conducive to rapid economic development. And but the countries of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, for the most part, do not. And the argument is that we won't permit it to appear. Notice that Japan, Japan is the one non-Western country that has experienced Western-style economic growth. Notice that Japan did it through a radical isolationist policy, or let's say behind a radical isolationist policy.
Paul,
Mark, what's the point of that? You, explain this isolationist
policy. Well, Japan did. Japan controlled foreign intervention in Japan.
Yeah.
Foreigners were allowed in, but the Japanese decided on what terms and who would come in, and they were in control of their own economy.
Now, then, carrying this one step further, then, in relationship to East and West Germany here, what would make the difference between a fantastic economy then in West Germany that started way back before World War II? Didn't this same type of economy exist in East Germany? And then what is the separation now?
Yeah. Well, you're asking a question that I really was avoiding tonight, and that is the question of whether capitalism or socialism is better for a developed country. In my view, capitalism is better. It works better. Socialism, I do not believe, works well in developed countries. And though there are other factors that would explain the much greater economic success of West Germany than East Germany, I believe that one of the important factors explaining the so-called economic miracle in West Germany and the rather abysmal record for many years of East Germany was a capitalist system versus a socialist system. I'm an unrepentant reactionary on this question. We've got 1 minute, so yeah.
So listen, their Bible study is beginning now, so we should bust up.
Before you mentioned that you think our policy in the future should be one of an isolationist policy, right?
Well, qualified, you know.
Am I right in assuming that you meant that we should have had one in the past?
No. What I'm really arguing for, Dave, is a very complicated thing. I hope the time comes when Americans I believe that every nation fundamentally must assume that it's going to act in accord with what it perceives to be its interest. That is to say, that the people who are in control of foreign policy are going to use what they think is the interest of the nation as the touchstone of foreign policy. And hence, I don't have much confidence in humanitarian impulses as a basis for foreign policy. I think it would be lovely if the United States just gave huge quantities of its wealth, sort of just laid them out, say, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, said, come and get them, you know. The trouble is, when we do give aid, we give it to particular people, and we always give it to our friends, and we do, I think, objectively, whatever our intentions might be, we objectively support regimes that are stifling economic growth in these countries. So, the only alternative that I see right now is for us to stop doing it. To call an end to intervention, and that means an end to foreign aid.
Do you agree that there is a pattern of foreign aid given to certain countries which we feel might be in jeopardy of communist intervention?
Sure. We don't deny it. We use foreign aid consciously as a tool of foreign policy, and even when we're not deliberately, consciously, and admittedly using it as a tool of foreign policy, we are using it as a tool of foreign policy.
Aid is a fancy word for fraud.
But in the long run, I would hope that Americans indeed become that our conception of our own interest embraces such a wide range of humanity that we find it possible to engage in actual acts of charity toward the world. Well, I think it will happen in the long run. I believe that there has been a steady evolution. Something called social progress, moving in this direction. That as history has gone on, just in the last, say, 2,000 years, men have learned to take account of the welfare of an ever wider range of other people.
I mean, you know, I mean, men originally were concerned only for the band, the little tribe. Everybody else was an outsider, and to hell with him. And then we extended that. And today, I think there really is a kind of a national community in this country. It's always in danger of breaking down. But, you know, we do feel that we got to do what's good for all Americans. I mean, in principle at least, if it hurts too much, we call a halt. But we do regard all Americans as proper objects of our help and our charity. And I see no reason why this couldn't be extended. So we would say, come to regard all people in the Western Hemisphere as part of a broader community. What I'm saying is, I do not rule out the eventual evolution of one world, where all of these imponderables that create actual community come to exist. But that's not around the corner.
Well, if it doesn't come about, you believe that, like, for instance, during the Depression, when we were completely isolationist, we had a pretty good, even though it was a time of crisis, we had a pretty good country because we directed all of our funds toward projects within the United States and, you know, as you said, to hell with the rest of the world, you know. Don't you think you could see that as possibly being successful, that we could keep within our own country?
Well, but if I'm not interested in our keeping within our own country so much for the sake of our own country as to keep us out of the affairs of other countries.
I don't think
that we had a very good society in the 1930s.
Paul, what that argument does not realize, if I just might put in one sentence here, if Japan, India, Africa, and all of the so-called underdeveloped nations of the world were to recall their doctors, lawyers, technicians, and people in other areas of expertise which make this country run, we would be in serious trouble. We never have really admitted that foreign aid was sort of a nice name for fraud. You see, I watch huge technical universities in India turning out thousands and thousands and thousands of electrical technicians with nothing to do. Well, where do they go?
They go to the United States?
You bet they do. Right. And San Francisco General tonight would close if these countries were to require their people, Indians and Africans and Orientals,
to stay home.
Yes. Yeah,
but they've got nothing for them to do.
They got nothing for them to do. It's planned.
It's planned?
Yes.
By whom?
By the United States. Now, let's take, you see, what looks Western is not always Western. Have you seen any of the training films of Japanese businessmen, for example?
No.
They are dedicated to the proposition of tricking every American businessman who comes to Japan. And it's the old, it's computer karate. That's what one Japanese calls it, you see. And it is not Western. It is uniquely Oriental.
Well,
and it so happens that other countries have not caught up with this. Indira Gandhi, at least the DMK in India, is a comer. And I hope that the fraud keeps coming to India.
You talked about the possible influence of economics on our foreign policy. To what extent do you think our foreign policy is shaped because of a reaction to what people who make our foreign policy feel is a military threat by Russia and China?
Yeah. I don't know. How does one find out what's going on in the minds of the people who are making foreign policy? I read Foreign Affairs, and I usually assume that tells me. I know that the people who are responsible for policy planning in the State Department like to throw up trial balloons and get some reaction from the academic community and so on. So you can frequently see what, or guess what ideas are floating around in the State Department by seeing what's appearing in Foreign Affairs. There is making inferences from this, I would say there is a strong tendency right now to minimize the military threat from China and go back to stress the importance of the military threat from Russia.
Right.
and weighing that against our economic or foreign policy based on economic would it seem to you that the military risk is a large factor in shaping American foreign policy?
I don't think it is. You see, suppose that let's assume that Russia that Russian foreign policy has nothing to do with communism, that it's just traditional old Russian chauvinism, you know, czarist expansionism with the Bolsheviks in charge, which many people assume, and I think there's a lot to it. In fact, that charge is being leveled now by the Marxists, too, who've read the Soviet Union out. They're revisionists, they're no longer true Marxists, and so on. Well, then the United States would have to keep up its strength, you know, Russia, preserve the balance of power, and so on. But I just don't believe that that would require us to do much intervening in third world countries. I really believe that, for example, Cuba, if it goes socialist and swears allegiance to Marx, Lenin, and Stalin, and Moscow too, is going to be an ally to Russia of negative value. Maybe in the short run there'll be a small value, so there'll be some propaganda value, but I think we pay too much attention to propaganda. I really get upset about all this talk about influencing world opinion. I don't think world opinion, when the chips are down, is worth two hoots and a holler. I really think that every time another country goes socialist and says, we're joining the Russian bloc, that the shrewdies in the Kremlin say, oh my God, another one to take care of. We can't control our allies, and they can't control their allies.
Yeah.
And one of the ways to security and strength is to keep down the number of untrustworthy allies where it drain on your resources.
Do you think that we're
No, that's my wife, so you finish. She can talk to you. Don't you mind? Well, let him finish.
She won't call on me.
I'll call. If I don't, I'm in trouble.
I hope I wasn't
going to say that.
Well, I think that we're
all
hopeful that the United States will
eventually
become the British Islands, Australia, New Zealand?
Well, whether we are, I don't think we are. I don't think we're irrevocably committed to defend anything, not even Chicago. You know, I mean, at some price, we'll give up anything. But the question of whether we are irrevocably committed isn't as important as whether these countries think we are irrevocably committed. And they don't think we are irrevocably committed. Which it helps to explain some of the tensions in our grand alliances. I mean, the countries, that's why NATO broke up, basically, because the countries of Western Europe were not willing to live behind the shield of American military might, because they were afraid that the crucial moment the U.S. might say, well, gee whiz, fellas, this is a worldwide struggle, and we think the best place to make the defense is at the Atlantic Ocean.
The Philippines.
You're expendable. Now, Julie, right here. She doesn't really want to say anything to me. She wants to make sure that you don't learn error.
No, this I want to say to you. Well, you talk about the State Department as though this rational group of men makes our foreign policy. Now, that's just, I think, just incredible to assume that the ridiculous foreign policy that we have had in the last 10 years and that we have now is made, by and large, by rational, scholarly men who publish articles in Foreign Affairs. When we were in Seattle on Monday, look at the Seattle paper, right on the front page, now there's this little blurb, and it says, there are missiles in Cuba. There are Russian missiles in Cuba, and it says, it's a very, very inflammatory thing, and it's UPI, and it's quoting somebody from the White House. And boy, the White House is getting very uptight about these little missiles in Cuba, and it's going back to the Kennedy confrontation with hoo-ha over the Cuban missiles, you know, and the big crisis. And that whole thing was building and building up and talking about Nixon and what he was saying about it, and we got to watch this very carefully, and we're going to have another kind of confrontation, and they better learn, they better not put their, you know, playing these kinds of stupid games now. See, oh, because there's some, you know, there are a couple of missiles in Cuba, and then the way that we continue to behave in Southeast Asia, in this rather insane fashion, doesn't bespeak to me of rational, scholarly, looking to one's own interest. I mean, the objective economic interest of the United States, you can be as chauvinistic as you want to, doesn't seem to be enhanced by our recent activities in Southeast Asia, or certainly what we might be planning to do now in Cuba. And if when the Chinese start rattling swords, because we're not very far from China on the borders, and we got this huge army standing there, we start talking about the warmongers in Peking, you know. It sounds like a crazy game. And I really don't understand how you can talk about the people who actually make the foreign policy the goals as being so rational. Yeah, I find it utterly terrifying. It scares me to death. If I think about it very long, I really get really scared about it.
If you're basing that on the reporting of the Seattle newspapers, I'd caution you.
Yeah, well, it was the UPI release. It wasn't the Seattle Reporter.
They're trying to sell newspapers in Seattle now. They've got very little else to sell.
Yeah, okay, I know that. But it was a real rattling thing about missiles in Cuba now. And it was quoting the president, and it was quoting other people, and about what they're going to do about it. With lots of warnings. Now, you know, why do you think they're rational people?
Jerry wanted to get something in.
Yeah, sure.
I was going to say a couple of things that really support that is the book called Vietnam is edited by Marvin Gettleman, and there's a speech in there by Walt Rustow, who was a foreign affairs advisor for...
Advisor for foreign affairs. Yeah,
for Johnson and Kennedy. And the speech is often quoted, and it's really ridiculous. I mean, what he says about Vietnam, and it was made in 1961, the things I see evolving. And Edwin O. Reischauer, who isn't by any sense anti-American or anything like that, wrote a book, Beyond Vietnam, in 1965, where he said how the Asian scholars, when he was in the State Department in 1946, 45 and 46, they were put down because they wanted to support Ho Chi Minh, and again this happened in 1954, and he said he wrote a book in 1954 which pointed out that pretty soon the U.S. was going to be involved in a war in Indochina if we didn't change our policy. So the scholars were saying, you know, we've got to look out because Vietnam's going to break out into the war, and apparently the White House, the men who make the policy, weren't listening.
Well, let me just say something to this. I have long operated with faith, but let's say the belief, not supported by adequate evidence, that our foreign policy is finally made by rational men, that the Secretary of State has under him, and of course the President has under him Secretary of State, and the Secretary of State has under him a large number of very knowledgeable and intelligent men, who get the best information from all sources and rationally calculate the potential costs and benefits of various actions, and that they feed this information up, and on the basis of that kind of information, decisions are made. Now, that is a belief unsupported by the evidence. I know for one thing about... Well, now, wait a minute. I know there have been articles written about the mess in the State Department and how good information can't get up to the top, how ideas get simplified and scuttled and all of that. There have been insider reports on it. But I still hang on to that belief for this reason, that it's the only constructive belief that I can entertain. As long as I recognize that irrationality and stupidity and mistakes are continually going to be creeping in, I pray that they may be small in number, and in recent years they've seemed to be large in number, but unless I assume a rational process going on there in Washington, I have no way of influencing it. The only way I know to influence my government is through the rational process. There is another way, and that is violent revolution. I won't take that route because I don't think it has a chance of success. And I don't have to give any reasons beyond that. Whether or not revolution is justified, revolution that can't possibly succeed is, in my view, never justified. So
are you aware of this myth? What you're saying is that you think it's necessary to Unless you take the option of violent revolution, and that obviously at the moment, at any rate, it doesn't have a chance right now. You know, and most really competent revolutionaries say that. They're thinking in terms of 50 years and 60 and 70, you know. But you're saying it is necessary to hold the myth of rationality there in order that one may influence it. Otherwise, you wouldn't speak because you'd be speaking to madmen.
Yes, when I assume that a guy is crazy, but I have no way of hand dealing with him anymore except locking him up. If I don't have the power to lock him up, it's pointless.
But what is how do you make a crazy man look sane?
Well, sometimes very hard, but no, I'm very seriously. One has to work.
I think that it's
isn't it true that our state, that our foreign policy has largely been dictated by the military for many years?
Well, the military has a voice, certainly, and maybe too big a voice, and it's awfully hard to know just how big a voice they have. But the military man, of course, by training, thinks that the solution is military. And military action is just one of the tools of diplomacy, and that's why the military has to be thoroughly under the control of the diplomats. And it's terribly dangerous to bring diplomats into the policy-making levels of government. And we've done it, so... But I wouldn't buy or subscribe to the notion that the military has dominated our foreign policy.
Don't you consider, though, that is the problem in Vietnam, is because the military has, I mean, since, say, 1954, has been the main influential factor in Indochina, in foreign policy towards Indochina?
Well, I think the military has fed a lot of bad prognoses into the government. You know, like we said, well, we can do it, we can win if... And they're continuing to do that. You know, there's still military men who say we can win in 2 months if.
The fountain of information, they deal with the information that they have in hand, but not always. Is that information accurate or balanced? The source of the information is sometimes falsified or exaggerated, and then they make decisions based on what they have on their hands, but they may not be true.
But that's very important.
Very careful with source. Yeah.
But my explanation for the Vietnam so-called mess is that we started off to intervene just a little, because that's a low-cost intervention. We thought that a little intervention would probably reap us a big gain in terms of the dominant theory. And then we just got more and more involved. We kept, you know, it's like a poker player who keeps putting in more chips and more chips, and after a while, you get to the point where you can't drop. Now, I'm going to abandon the poker metaphor because it doesn't work. It doesn't work any longer. What has happened now is that we have gone so far. We have sacrificed the lives. Let's not even think about the Vietnamese. We have sacrificed the lives. We have how many American young men? How many Americans have been mutilated for life by our 15 years in Vietnam? Suppose that we now pull out and say, well, we thought we could do it, but we can't. It's gotten too costly. What we are likely to gain just isn't worth what we're likely to lose. So we quit. That is saying to all Americans, we goofed, we blew it. And that means, that's saying to every mother and father of a dead son, to every American soldier with no ears, one leg, you made your sacrifice to no avail, for no purpose. Now that is a very hard thing for people to accept and believe. It is no accident that some of the most virulent hawks in this country are veterans, wounded veterans, and the relatives of people who lost their lives in Vietnam. That ain't no accident. And these people, there is a tremendous empathy, I think, with these people on the part of a lot of Americans. Plus, something that I just can't take as seriously, and what I've just said I take very seriously. This is a real tragedy. That is that Americans have a tendency to treat wars the way they treat football games. Russell Baker, who usually remains fairly apolitical, had a brilliant comment on that when Nixon said, you know, I will not be the first American president to preside over a defeat. You know, that's a terrible, terrible statement. Just terrible. But I think that strikes a deeply responsive chord in the hearts of many Americans. And I think that is what has boxed us in to Vietnam.
You see, I heard that run down very, very similar by another economist at the University of California. His conclusion, however, was a conclusion. And he says a lot of folks don't see him when he stands up and when he says, may God bless all of the people of this state, both black and white. But you will if we pull out of Vietnam without winning. You know, in other words, he predicts, you know, a horrible defeat for Nixon and everybody connected with him and the election of George Wallace, you know. And, you know, if it should happen prior to the next election. These are frightening possibilities. And so then the guy said, well, it sort of makes you want to pull for Nixon, you know, sort of makes you want to support his Cambodian decision, sort of makes you want to, you know, support every idiotic thing he does, basically because of the high emotional content. I think you're right, Paul. There is a rational reading of the emotional fervor connected to this Vietnam thing, and at the same time, a finagling to hold on to one's political sweatshirt, because that's what, you know, Nixon is in, not quite a straitjacket, but a sweatshirt now. Mm-hmm. And he sort of looks to idiots like Ronald Reagan and others to get him out of it. And of course, you know, all of the things that happened after the election down there, you know, Nixon is trying hard to rescue nearly half of this country right now that George Wallace has. If he got 10 million the last time, they have tripled that figure, you know, since all of the emotional thing with Vietnam, campus unrest, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, has come up. So there is a rational reading of it from that angle.
Well, on this matter of how we got where we are, and of course it doesn't do much good to cry over spilled milk, but Eric Hoffer, you know, the quote uneducated longshoreman, had a statement which I think had a lot of meat in it. You know, you may disagree with it, but he said essentially, this country's foreign policy since World War II has been to prevent World War III. And this, to him, explains our involvement in Berlin and Europe and NATO and the CETO and Cuba and Korea and Vietnam. Now, admittedly, we've gone too far. Maybe he would admit that we've gone too far into Vietnam. But I guess this is the haunting fear behind a lot of us, is if now we retreat into isolationism, are we going to get into another 1930 mess of a Hitler type thing takeover, and which goes too far, and then we do get a World War III. I think this is the fear of withdrawing in our horns everywhere in the world.
That's why I shouldn't use the word isolationism, really, because I don't really have in mind drawing in our horns, and I just tossed it in, but it probably wasn't emphasized as much as I should have. That the United States has tremendous power, and we cannot deny that. We cannot just pull in our horns. I'm really calling for pulling in our horns, in the horns that are extended in some very particular directions, to be much less concerned about the social political revolutions occurring in the less developed countries. But I do not want the United States to disengage itself from Europe, and certain other places. I mean, I believe that the Russian military threat is a very real one. And I do think it's more Russian than communist. But I think that we have to preserve military strength, and that means we're going to have to be intervening around the world, feeling our way, playing the game, the diplomatic game. Yeah, so.
I think that is necessary to prevent World War III.
Paul, certainly America's foreign policy prior to World War II allowed dabbling in brush fires such as the Manana Wars in South America. Mm-hmm. The amphibious tactics of the Marines were thoroughly tested and prior to, not thoroughly, but at least were initially tried out in South America prior to World War II. Do you think that there's any of that type of thinking going on now? And was Vietnam a brush fire that turned into a forest fire?
Yeah.
Because we allowed the military to dabble down there. Not realizing it might get out of hand.
Yeah, well, whether that's the reason or not, I think, yeah, it's a good example of a brush fire that turned into a forest fire. Because we just grossly underestimated the strength of the Vietnamese determination to be free from any kind of foreign interference. And, of course, we never really had, the Vietnamese are fiercely nationalist, and we never had an effective Vietnamese government to support. Diem came closest, and he was corrupt, and there were certain other problems with it, and he didn't get along with the Buddhists and so on, and so we decided Diem had to go, we'd come up with a better one, and we'd come up with a succession of worse ones, and the South Vietnamese government that we're supporting is, I think, even the Republicans admit it's a laughing stock.
Well, what's your impression of the situation in the Near East? I guess that's what you call it, the Israel-Arab confrontation. How close are we to World War III? And
I don't know. I really wonder what the Russian interest is down there. I don't know. I mean, it certainly makes sense for the Russians to support the Arabs. I mean, it'd be silly for them not to support the Arabs. I mean, tremendous benefits, large benefits, small risks, you know. But if supporting the Arabs carries them toward a confrontation with the United States, then it's considerable benefits, large risks, and then they might pull back. But the question is, what interest does the United States have in supporting Israel? Well, you can talk about the huge Jewish vote, but also Americans tend to just root for Israel. You know, there are some anti-Semites floating around, but Israel... Yeah, that sort of thing. I would like to see the United States put pressure on Israel, because I don't think Israel will do it until the United States leans heavy. Put pressure on Israel to deal with the Palestinians and to satisfy the demands of the Palestinians. You know, it's a very interesting thing that has occurred in the last couple of years is that the Palestinians have achieved some leadership that is pretty independent of Cairo. And the Israelis are just refusing to deal with them and are still talking as if all of the trouble there is a result of the Arab nation's refusal to admit that Israel exists and will continue to exist. Now, that's just not true. A good part of the trouble is a result of Israel's refusal to admit that the Palestinians got a raw deal. And if Israel will not face that, I don't see any possibility of a solution.
What would it take? You say there is no solution.
Well, they want to return to their homelands. They want to return to their homelands with guarantees that they will be economically and politically safe and secure.
They're willing to live under Israel with those guarantees.
Yeah. They don't want to be second-class citizens in Israel. Of course, the Israel the Israeli answer, when they bother to answer at all, is you're asking us to admit a whole bunch of fifth columnists into our country. No, it's time to go to bed. Any time to go to bed?
Would you comment on the Rockefeller report from his visit down in North America? What was your impression of his report?
I didn't read it, so I got very truncated reports and I didn't follow it up.
Okay.